Salutations, Mets fans. Welcome to this week's edition of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation, New York Mets site Amazing Avenue. As always, I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me, as usual, is Rob Castellano. Rob, winter meetings in a week. The Mets are starting to do things. It's getting kind of exciting.
Or sad if you're one to mourn the loss of one very polarizing, highly self-righteous infielder, outfielder, but we'll get to that later, I suppose.
We'll let you say your goodbyes to Jordani Valdez for in time, Rob. First things first, as usual, it's episode 44 of Amazing Avenue Audio. We have to name it. And look, it's my podcast, so it's going to be the Last Things Millage edition. I know Rob doesn't. Rob has a different idea than me, but Blasting's Thrillage was a very important part of my development as a prospect writer. Spoiler alert, I missed a little bit on him, to say the least. And I just want to say that he is available. His contract with the Tokyo Yakult Swallows expired after last season. He's only 29. He had a bit of a down year for Yakult, so I think he'll probably come cheap. So maybe they should look into it.
That's definitely what you want to hear on a free agent bargain. A down year with the occult.
They have the new baseball, too, which like allowed like record-breaking home run performances, and his OPS dropped by 100 points. But, you know, he shows some pretty good power in a league that that suppresses power to a certain extent. So I'd go with it. I'm fine with it would have been good if they could have gotten Carlos Gomez and put Gomez and Millage in the outfield. That would have been perfect, but
I guess I'm just a more vindictive person than you, because I pretty much have the same backstory. He was like one of the first real prospects, top 100 guys that the Mets had that I sort of followed and watched, and the way it panned out sort of left me and Lastings on bad terms. So I was happy to go with David Cone as our number 44, but I suppose Millage is probably a pretty fair choice as well, as long as it's not Jason Bay, basically.
As long as it's not Jason Bay, yes, we can agree with that. I have fond memories of Millage. I mean, I wrote a piece for Mason Avenue a couple of years ago, sort of looking back at him as a prospect and how he maybe kind of should have seen this outcome coming, though I would have hoped he would at least caught on as a fourth outfielder a little bit longer than he did. Them's the breaks and whatnot, but I enjoyed like his debut. Well, I don't think it was his debut, but his first major league home run when he ran out and like high-fived all the fans. I thought that was great. And it worked up the New York media, and Billy Wagner didn't like him, which I guess, I don't know if that's actually an indictment of Millage's personality, but we saw something similar, not the same, but maybe a difference of degree rather than kind with Jordani Valdezman, who was non-tendered today, along with Scott Acheson and Omar Quintanilla. We're going like up-to-the-minute news, which will be many, many minutes ago when you actually listen to this. But the up-to-the-minute news, as we record this on Monday night, is the Mets have non-tendered Scott Acheson, Omar Quintanilla, and Jordani Valdezman. And they have till the end of the night, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to make any further decisions on non-tenders. And it sounds like there's at least a possibility, as of 7:23 p.m., that there may be more coming. We'll see. If anything breaks on Twitter while we're recording, we'll be the first to talk about it, but you probably won't be the first to know through this podcast, at least, because it won't go up.
as a source for your news, it's probably not a great one. Better in terms of our repercussions and reactions.
I guess we'll pay at least a little bit of lip service to Scott Acheson and Omar Quintanilla. No real surprise here, Rob?
Nah, I mean, I guess you could say, looking back 12 months, Acheson looked like a good signing. He was, that trendy best reliever you've never heard of acquisition. But, in terms of performance, he left a lot to be desired.
It sounds like the Mets have at least left the door open for him to maybe come back as a minor league free agent or a non-roster invitee in the future. Whether that happens or not remains to be seen. Omar Quintanilla, I imagine something similar could happen. I can't really see Omar Quintanilla getting a 40-man spot with another team. But then again, the Baltimore Orioles traded for him midseason last year, so stranger things have indeed happened.
Indeed they have.
but we bid a fond farewell. Well, one of us bids a fond farewell to Jordani Valdespin. And this is pretty much, you know, he wasn't eligible for arbitration. He was just going to get the league minimum or something close to it again next year. So this is very much a deliberate parting of the ways on by the Mets standpoint. So Rob, Jordani Valdespin is your guy. Give us, how are you feeling? Tell us about your thoughts right now on the on this sad day.
I guess I'm in the stage of denial, so I'm like questioning the sources. Like, who said he was cut? I mean, do we know that that's a reputable source? I don't know. But if the sources are to be believed and the information's true that the Mets have parted ways with him, it's not an outright surprise, not by, you know, even his staunchest fans, myself probably being one of them. I mean, he just didn't.
Being one of them, Rob?
Being the one.
Being the one, yes.
I mean, I'm assuming his mom is probably is a pretty, pretty big fan. So me and his mom are sort of surprised, but not really. I mean, he played so damn bad last year, and it's hard to get around the fact that, you know, for all the issues with attitude and misconduct and the fact that he's just out and out a pretty bad teammate altogether, he was a bad player. And, you know, for all of the talent and, you know, tools that he's shown over his minor league and sort of brief major league career, you know, he's one of those guys that it's easy to see, or at least easy to project, that it's probably not going to come together for him. He's not young. He's, what, he turned 26 this year or 25?
I think he turns 26 in December sometime this month. I think he's a December birthday.
Yeah, so for a guy that's, you know, still trying to establish himself at the major league level, he's not young by any means. Again, he put up numbers. I mean, he put up nearly a 780 OPS as a middle infielder in the minors. You know, he hit for plenty of power and stole lots of bases. On the surface, you look at that and you figure, we can make that work somehow. We have to find a way to make that work, because you just don't find guys like that. And I don't think anyone, including the Mets, are going to doubt that he has that ability. The athleticism is there. I mean, we saw it in his rookie season. The power, you really can't doubt it. I mean, in his 94 games, it was a 183 ISO power, which is extremely high, especially for a middle infielder. Yeah, I guess the fact that they didn't really play him there doesn't help. As an outfielder, he's not nearly as valuable. And, I mean, that sort of leads to the issue of, you know, why he didn't fit on this team. You know, all of this stuff sort of comes together in sort of a bitter package of a player that just didn't seem to fit. You know, whether he was a stand-up citizen or not, again, first and foremost, he was just really bad last year. What he bat, something like, it was 188, 250 on base, and 316 slugging, which, just as we know from, you know, noted Mets favorite Mike Baxter, it's just not going to cut it. So really shouldn't be all that surprising, but it is sort of a bummer for a guy who, if you wanted to dream on him and, you know, if you were sort of a fan of his, you could see him putting it all together and being, you know, 15 home run, 15 stolen base middle infielder, which would have been extremely valuable, but alas, won't happen, at least not in Queens.
And probably, to be perfectly honest with you, not anywhere else. I don't see, I guess somebody will take a flyer on the talent, head case aside. And what it really comes down to is, yeah, he was probably a dick, and I can tell you stories about him being a dick, and I'm sure you're going to hear plenty of stories from beat writers in the coming days with the embargo lifted about just how big a dick he was. But if you hit, no one really cares if you're a dick. And he didn't hit. And here we are. No more Jordani Valdespin.
Yeah,
we'll always have the ridiculous 3-run home run against Jonathan Papelbon.
He had a couple of those really dramatic home runs, which you won't be able to take away from him. But he's definitely one of those guys that he had a short window. Didn't happen during that window. And who knows if he'll ever get another opportunity quite like that.
So those are non-tenders. If any more non-tenders come down the pipe while we're recording, we'll clue you in as well, or at least talk about them a little bit. The other sort of Mets-related news this week but not really. But I have a rant. I don't rant often on the podcast, and the last time I ranted, it did not work out well for me. But I feel more confident in my moral position here. If you recall, last time I had a rant on the podcast, I ranted about the Mets not trading Marlon Byrd at the July 31st trading deadline. I took Sandy to task for his inaction and complained they really should have got something for him, seeing as they weren't going to re-sign him. And then a month later, he got Dilson Herrera and Vic Black. But in this case, my rant has to do with the Hall of Fame ballot. And no, this won't be a screed about Deadspin buying a vote or spurious PED accusations or anything, or about, you know, Jack Morris making, or anything actually having to do with the ballot, because I don't care. Look, I've been to the Hall of Fame. I like Cooperstown. It's a nice museum. If Mike Piazza gets in this year, as he should, and goes in as a Met, as he probably should, I mean to get back up there to the toward the Omegang Brewery. There's a nice little bed and breakfast about a half hour away that my wife and I have stayed at before, and I'd be happy to hit up again. It'll be a nice little trip, but I really don't have any strong feelings on the Hall of Fame ballot anymore, except in this one particular instance. And this instance being, Edgardo Alfonso is not on the Hall of Fame ballot again, and this pisses me off. Armando Benitez on the Hall of Fame ballot, not as good a player as Fonzie. Paul Laduca on the Hall of Fame ballot, not as good a player as Fonzie. And not even like in the same discussion, really, in terms of peak or career value. Fonzie was eligible for the first time last year, wasn't on the ballot. He's eligible again this year, obviously. Doesn't make the ballot. Now look, is Edgardo Alfonso a Hall of Famer? Look, if they want to vote him in, I'm more than happy to go to his induction as well, but probably not. Jay Jaffe's Jaws metric has him 64th at third base, and a smooth 40 war short of the career mark and 14 war short of the peak mark for third baseman, which is where he rates. I assume that's where he played most of his games. But look, he's in the same breath as guys like Travis Fryman, Ken Caminiti, in terms of Jaws value, and those guys rightfully made a Hall of Fame ballot. I'm not even saying Fonzie's like necessarily good enough to get sort of the, you know, the token vote from a dude or two. Certainly not enough to make 5% and stay on multiple years. But I think it's, especially from the ballot where it is, where you have, you know, 16 to 18 potential Hall of Famers or people that should be in the Hall of Fame on the ballot this year. But I think it would just be nice for him to get, you know, the two-line retrospective from Joe Posnanski or from some other sports writer when they go through and do their yes-nos for the ballot. Because Edgardo Alfonso was a hell of a player. Back-to-back 6-win seasons for Met. I mean, his 99 and 2000 season. I mean, he was arguably, I mean, Olerud's 99 was amazing. Don't get me wrong. But he was arguably the best player on those 99 and 2000 Mets teams. You know, even better than Piazza, who at that point was a little bit past his peak. We didn't have sort of the gaudy home run and RBI numbers that Piazza had, but I mean, 40 doubles both seasons, 25 home runs, and he drove in 100 runs in 1999. And you can make a case that he maybe should have been a little bit higher than 8th in the MVP balloting. I mean, look, he's going to go into the Mets Hall of Fame probably as soon as this year. I think they probably have a... He should be the next guy to go in. He's stayed in contact with the team. He was at Piazza's Hall of Fame induction this year. Coached the or managed the world team at the Futures game. I got to stand like 5 feet from him and watch batting practice. That was pretty damn cool, I have to say. But I just want to see, you know, Fonzie get a little more respect, or at least as much respect as Armando Benitez.
Yeah, not setting the bar all that high.
I'm not. It's like, and it's like thing. He had a long enough career. He made all the qualifications. You know, he was worth almost 30 wins in his career. It's not a Hall of Fame career. He had a pretty good peak. I mean, he had actually a really good peak from 97 to 2002. He had a couple down seasons in there, but you know, by Baseball Reference, in 8 years with the Mets, he was worth almost 30 wins. Actually, I can do math. He was worth almost 5 wins per... almost exactly 5 wins per 150 games played for the Mets. That's, you know, an all-star level player.
Yeah, if you want to stick at that threshold, there's only one other Mets position player who's posted 4 or 5 WAR seasons for the Mets, that being David Wright. No other Mets position players have ever done that. So, I mean, just limiting to the discussion to, Mets history, and obviously that's much more storied in terms of the pitching. But I mean, he's up there just in terms of the franchise's great position talent alone.
Yeah, pretty good. Well, more than pretty good. I mean, we've been spoiled by Carlos Beltran, but a pretty good postseason hitter too. 299, 369, 521 in 28 postseason games. Of course, had some big games for the Mets, some big homers for the Mets, in the 99 NLDS specifically. And he played well in pretty much every outside of the 2000 World Series, every postseason series he played with the Mets. Whatever you think of quote unquote clutch statistics, Alfonso came up big for them as sort of many memorable hits, memorable bats, memorable games. Play everywhere on the diamond. I think that's part of the problem too, is that he played multiple positions, and those guys tend to get underrated.
Well, they did then. Nowadays, we sort of have a sense that we should value them higher, whether or not we can or not. A guy like Ben Zobrist, people agree, is ultra valuable. But at that point, people didn't tend to put a ton of stock into that.
It's true. It was more moving around, I guess, than playing multiple positions like Zobrist does. He played second when they had Robin Ventura, and third otherwise for the most part, a little bit of short here and there. But yeah, give Fonzie some more respect. I ranted about this last year with Matt Callen, and I'm doing it again this year, and I'll do it every single year until they put him on the ballot, even if he falls off immediately. I don't expect the Baseball Writers Association of America to get right on that though. They have bigger. They just invest in a new website first. We'll go from there.
Well, it's a noble cause, and you have my full support. I mean, I don't get it. I guess it's just
I
longevity
guess
tax.
his name just didn't come up. I don't know. I mean, Jock Jones made it this year, and he barely had enough years to qualify.
Yeah, that's strange. I mean, he had. I guess the problem is that his peak was just it was relatively short.
Jock
Two
Jones had
careers.
no peak. I don't know why I keep coming back to Jock Jones. I actually wanted Jock Jones as a Met at some point. I forget exactly when that was, but
Good for you that you cop to
I do. At
that.
some point, I thought he'd be a useful platoon outfielder. I'm going to guess it was like, well, he had to have been retired for at least 5 years now, which so it couldn't have been that recently. I already have a soft spot for Jock Jones. Who's
Yeah,
the
I
other?
mean,
There's the other one. The other ex-Cubs outfielder that's in Japan now. Matt Merton.
oh, Matt Martin,
Maybe I'm
okay.
confusing Jock Jones and Matt Merton, but I'm pretty sure I wanted both of them at some point.
Yeah, Matt Mertens. Everybody wanted him at some point, but
Speaking of players you can get cheap, like, say, Matt Merton, I got a question on Twitter coming into this past Thanksgiving holiday about, maybe some Black Friday deals that Sandy should look into. So I took this to mean kind of like cheap, low cost, maybe high risk or low upside free agent signings to fill out the roster, assuming that the big ticket items stay out of the Mets price range. And I mentioned a few of them, I think, back onto my AAOP, Jeff Baker, most recently of the Rangers, who might be a little bit more of a luxury now that the Mets have another right-handed outfield bat in Chris Young. But I'll put him on there too. One name that jumped out at me as being available and probably uber cheap, and probably for good reason, is Munenori Kawasaki, most recently of the Toronto Blue Jays. I mean, yeah, he can't really hit, but he can play a capable shortstop and second base, could be a useful backup middle infielder while Wilfredo Tovar gets some seasoning in AAA. And by all accounts, he's a really great clubhouse guy, really fun to have around. His teammates seem to love him, and if that stuff matters, and it does, as we've seen with Justin Turner, he's like the Japanese Justin Turner, I guess. And I'm fine with trying the Japanese Justin Turner instead of the American Justin Turner for a while.
He is about the most charismatic guy you're ever gonna, especially considering the fact that I don't think he speaks much English, and yet he just tends to like incense people in his own clubhouse and you know, just in the fan base. He just generates so much good feeling that there's got to be something to it.
He really is he's like the middle infield version of Tsuyoshi Shinjo, I think. Maybe I was thinking about that recently because of Steve Sipa's piece on what Shinjo's been up to lately. But he is kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's only one Shinjo. But he would be a reasonable facsimile of Shinjo, I think.
I'm definitely in support of that one.
And I mean, I think he'd probably make something close to the league minimum.
I got to imagine that because, like you said, he can't hit. I mean, he can't really play all that much, but he absolutely has enough heart to somehow make up for it.
Yeah, and it's, you know what, he's going to, yeah. I mean, his numbers aren't good, let's be perfectly honest. But he's a bench piece. But, you know, he can play shortstop. He can play second base. And he's, at least by the metrics, been above average there. So, 218, 306, 276 for his career. Yeah, that's not great. He's a little better in Toronto. I mean, he was 1.3 wins above replacement, about half a season in Toronto. A lot of that's due to middle infield defense, but you know, it's something for a bench piece. I think that's perfectly cromulent.
Here's a self-serving one for you. This is sort of a player contingent on additional moves, specifically whether or not the Mets decide to move Dan Murphy. Second base is already sort of up in the air. Even with Murphy, there's a lot going on over there between, you know, will Flores ultimately take second? Will Eric Young be featured there? A guy that I've loved since, you know, I started following baseball, or at least, you know, had a fantasy baseball team, was Brian Roberts. I love that guy.
And what is it with you and Baltimore Orioles on this podcast?
I don't know. I guess you're right. I never really noticed that, but there is something about them that just entrances me. And Roberts has always been one of them who, you know, in his heyday back in like the 05 through 08 years, he was putting up year in, year out, you know, 5 to at his peak 7 WAR seasons. He hasn't been able to stay healthy in years, and he's, you know,
is it concussion issues? Is that his?
Yeah, that was it. That was sort of it. I mean, he was having these freak injuries, sort of like, you know, Justin Morneau or even Jason Bay, where it was hard to blame him for the injuries. At this point, he's turning 36, so he's not someone you should really count on for. He's not going to be the starting second baseman, but as like a ultra diehard fan of it, he carried my fantasy team year.
Yeah, I figured that's what it was going to come back to.
Oh, it always does.
He was a all world fantasy player in the mid 2000s.
Oh, he stole bases, he hit home runs, ton of doubles. And I mean, he still shows you the ability that he still walks just enough. He still hits for, you know, relatively similar power, just that he doesn't play all that much. Would he fit on the Mets? Probably not really. He's probably more of an AL player at this point. If you can hide him in the DH spot, you'll get more out of him. But as a guy who, you know, if you can you know, platoon him in and out of a starting role at second, feature him off the bench as, you know, some good left-handed pop. He's a guy who I'd be interested to look at. He's, you know, obviously he's got very little buzz around his name. You're going to get him for, you know, about as cheap as you could ask. And he's a guy.
And I wouldn't be shocked if he's a minor league with a spring training invitation type guy.
Exactly. But like I said, he still showcases the skills that made him, at his peak in 2005, a 7 WAR player. It's just a matter of staying on the field. And if you limit his playing time, I think he could be interesting.
Surprised he didn't go for Grady Sizemore.
That's so cliche at this point.
Well, here's news that won't be news by the time you hear it. Apparently, the Nationals have traded for Doug Fister.
Wow, interesting.
Chris Cotillo is having quite the offseason for MLB Daily Dish. He broke the Nolasco deal. Had the Mets on Arroyo before anybody else, and now might be breaking the Nationals getting Doug Fister.
Does he know any other details about the deal? Like what they gave up?
Nope, nothing yet. I'm sure by the time you hear this, you'll know. But we don't. So moving on. More possible Black Friday bargains. How about Chris Capuano?
That's an interesting one.
The Dodgers declined his option, so he'd probably be had on a one-year deal. He struggled a little bit for them last year, but coming off two good seasons before that, at least in terms of his peripherals. You know, the guy that can give you innings, left-handed veteran, obviously has pitched in New York before. Sort of as an in-between signing between, like, the, you know, the Philly Hughes's, Jason Vargas's of the world, and the lower-end, riskier signings like, say, Jeff Karstens or Josh Johnson, a guy that you can get on a short deal. Doesn't have a ton of upside, but can give you some innings at a better clip than, like, Mike Pelfrey. I think he might have some promise.
Now, would you give him a starting role or use him sort of like the Dodgers where they tossed him out of the pen a little bit, started him a little bit?
You know, I'd let him – I'd see what he has in the spring, basically. He can start for me. Maybe shift him more into a swingman role if Montero and Syndergaard are ready. But – I think I don't see a reason why he can't start and pencil him in to the number five spot in that rotation. I mean, Mejia is far from a sure thing to be healthy and effective. So I think assuming he has a rotation spot wouldn't be the worst idea in the world if you bring him in. I mean, you might have to be perfectly honest with you. You might have to guarantee him a rotation spot or at least innings to get him. You know, he's a left-handed veteran starter. He's going to glom on somewhere. I mean, I don't have a huge... If you're not going to go out and sign... My God, who's even left at this point? If you're not going to sign, like, a guy to a 2 or 3 year deal and guarantee him... If you're not going to sign Bronson Arroyo, I don't see why you don't go out and get Capuano and say, all right, you're our fifth starter. I can roll with that.
Yeah, because especially like you said, he had that 1 year cameo that went pretty well. I mean, he gave you. I mean, it wasn't amazing. It was a 4 or 5 ERA, but I mean, beyond that, he gave you 186 innings. We saw that, you know, at his peak when he was pitching well, he was really effective. There was that one, you know, what was that? That complete game, like two hitter. That was one of like the top 7 or 8. Highest game scores in Mets starting.
Oh, he could absolutely miss bats. He has some home run issues, which you expect for a lefty without much in the way of velocity and a changeup specialist. That's not to be wouldn't be too surprised. You actually saw, I think it was Prince Fielder hit about the furthest home run I think I've seen at Citi Field live when I was there for the Baseball Prospectus Day. He actually, I believe if I recall, he broke a seat in the second deck in right field.
Nice.
The ball may have still been going up when it hit.
Wow, I missed that one.
It was some crazy back and forth game. Angel Pagan hit a home run late to tie it, and then I think Isringhausen blew it in the ninth.
I may have to Google that just to see a seat broken.
It was pretty intense. It was from 2011. Obviously, I was just here with the Mets. But, yeah, I mean, he had 4.5 ERA, but he probably pitched a little better than that. And he pitched, you know, he's like, he'll be around a 4 ERA guy. But he's certainly capable of giving you innings. He threw 200 last year for the Dodgers. You know, a bit of a down year, some injury issues. Spent some time in the pen, but... I mean, would I be surprised if he was better than Bronson Arroyo, at least for 2014? No. He's actually a year or two younger, so he's got that going for him.
Okay, here's one. This one's not so much, you know, Black Friday bargain shopping. Here's a guy who's probably going to get paid at least a little bit, but I think he probably should still be viewed as a sort of a bargain item, and that's Nate McLaus. Again, going back to the Baltimore Orioles.
Nate McLaus, I feel like he's been left for dead a couple times now.
Yeah, and he always tends to sort of revive himself for his career. And just last season, he didn't light the world on fire for the Orioles, but he certainly was useful. He batted .260, .330 on base, and a .400 slug, 12 home runs. He didn't play every day. not necessarily that he was a bench player, but he did miss some time, it looks like, with injuries. So he played in about 145 games. Based on the power numbers, based on the fact that someone like Curtis Granderson, who the Mets are talking to, wants, you know, upwards of four years, he's a guy who's going to get attention. Would he be a, you know, somewhat plausible alternative to a guy like Granderson or, you know, Nelson Cruz or someone like that? I wouldn't be shocked.
It's worth noting that the Mets, with the acquisition of Chris Young, and assuming they want to play him with Juan Lagares, those are two right-handed bats that don't hit right-handed pitching great. And we don't know if Lagares hits any kind of major league pitching great, but he has shown a bit of a platoon split even in the minors. You know, McLeod would give him a left-handed bat that's hit righties pretty well for his career. You know, can play a little center in a pinch, obviously a rather large pinch. But, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I have, like, the image of Nate McLeod in my head is probably not fair to Nate McLeod, but, I mean, he was pretty much, he had a 9 OPS for Pittsburgh in 2012 when I believe he got designated for assignment.
Yeah, at his lowest, he was looking really, I mean, back in.
And he had two really bad seasons with Atlanta before that.
Yeah, and basically that's what I remember, the Braves days when he looked like he was trying to play himself out of baseball. He was hitting like 190, 228 the next year, and it just looked like, all right, he peaked early. I don't know what happened. He's only 28, but he seems to be falling off a cliff. And like I said, he sort of revived his career. He's back to batting, you know, semi-acceptable 240, 250-ish, but he gives you power from the left side, solid defender, still only 31 years old, so, you know, not too far gone where you don't want to bring him in. And like I said, rather have a guy like Granderson, but is he like a reasonable facsimile at, you know, a much cheaper rate? Probably. I think he's definitely someone that they'll sniff around on him.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if he might be the guy that's sort of the last chip to fall. He might end up getting more than you think, just a team that missed out on some of the bigger name outfielders fall back to Nate McLeod as their plan C. But you know, I wouldn't hate Nate McLeod. And we're really grasping at straws at this point in the offseason already, which is not a good sign.
Yeah, but it always seems to sort of come to this. Sandy's not a fast mover.
No. Now, one place there certainly won't be any Black Friday bargains, as we've seen, is at shortstop. Yes, folks, it's time once again for Shortstop Avenue Audio. Somebody posted this as a fan post, I think semi-seriously, on the website today, and I threatened to bring it up on the podcast. And I'm actually, it sounds like an absolutely horrible idea until you think about it. It's a fan post from commenter Sotak803, and just says, Justin Turner, ellipsis, he has an extra dot in there, but we won't hold that against him, the Mets' next shortstop. That sounds crazy. That's like sounds like something I would do to troll you on the podcast, which I might be doing. We don't know. It's possible. I'm not going to tell you. But then I thought about it for a little bit because I was bored at work. And let's put it this way. Justin Turner, we know what Justin Turner is. He's a slightly below league average hitter that's somewhat batting average dependent. But, you know, a guy that makes pretty good contact, and he'll probably hit somewhere between 260 and 280. By OPS plus, as a Met, the last 3 years, 94, 97, 100. We can always call him, it's a little bit, it's just not a great on-base percentage, depending how you want to weight that, but pretty close to a league average hitter. Let's just look at, he's been exactly league average with the bat for his Mets career, basically. Looking at Baseball Reference's batting runs. The problem is he's not a very good second baseman. So, using some deductive reasoning, he's probably not a very good shortstop.
Yeah, safe to say, considering we've seen him there in little bits and bites over the last couple of seasons, and it's never that pretty.
But given the Mets' other options, Ruben Tejada, which you don't know what you're getting, and Wilfredo Tovar, where you probably do know what you're getting, at least at this point in time, and it's not super inviting. How bad a shortstop defensively would Turner have to be the clearly the worst option of the three?
I guess he'd have to be pretty bad. I mean, like everything when we discuss shortstop with the Mets, depends on Tejada's season and whether he bounces back or not. But let's just sort of assume that the Tejada we see is sort of in between what we've seen in the past. So, you know, not all that great. You know, Turner is so much better offensively, at least in terms of, you know, what he's been able to do pretty consistently, like you said. He'd have to be pretty bad to be worse than Tejada.
Terry Collins would be absolutely thrilled that we're having this discussion, by the way. This would get me hired on Terry Collins' staff, just the fact that we're having this discussion. But let's look at it this way. So you play 150 games at shortstop a year, let's say. You get, we'll actually go through and break this down category by category. 150 games at shortstop gets you roughly 8 runs of positional adjustment and 20 runs of replacement. So you're plus 28 runs, about 9 or 10 runs per win. So you're talking about almost a 3-win player just on that. So really, if he was minus 15 as a shortstop, again, assuming league average hitting and base running, which I think is probably reasonable for Turner, you know, that's still a 1.5-win shortstop. It's not great. It's a second division starter. But it might be the Mets' best option.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little scary that it's come up to this, but if they do end up coming into camp with, you know, the players that we see before us, if even a guy like Rafael Furcal is, you know, being paid far more handsomely than we thought he would or any of these shortstops would coming into the offseason, well, then I think you have to seriously consider it, as scary as that is to say.
I do think something that tends to get, I mean, there are places teams will play a minus 15 defender. I don't know if shortstop's one of them. Catcher certainly isn't one of them. And again, it depends on how sort of, I'm using minus 15 as just a sort of a, like a ballpark figure, a descriptive rather than actual like prescriptive number from the metrics. I'm trying to give sort of like a value proposition, and teams might view him, depending on how the team views him as a shortstop. I mean, they view him, they'll play him there in emergency or as a once a week guy. They've shown that in the past, so they at least think he can hack it. It's not that far-fetched in my mind that this could happen. I'm not endorsing it necessarily, but given the dearth of options elsewhere, at least ones that'll come cheaply, it's intriguing to me. I'm struggling with my feelings about Justin Turner because I think they're well known. He's has his uses. I think it was Steve Schreiber. Maybe it was you. I think it was Steve Schreiber that pointed out, you know, Justin Turner is better than paying $6 million for Willie Blomquist, who's not as good as Justin Turner.
Yeah, it sounds like a Steveism, and I think it's probably true. I mean, you know what he's going to give you. It's not going to be great. But if he hits 270 or 275 and hits, you know, 3 home runs, steals a few bases and, you know, not much else, it's not necessarily going to help you all that much, but it's not going to hurt you all that much. Again, assuming that he's not just aberrant defensive shortstop. So, yeah, I think, you know, obviously you continue to look around for better options. You know, there really would be no excuse for not bringing in some sort of minor league invite, no matter who it is. I mean, early on we thought it would be a guy like Furcal, but it looks like he'll get paid, and you know, guys like Willie Blomquist and that sort of ilk, those guys are getting paid this offseason, so you're going to have to be more creative. You know, a name that I thought back to earlier this week was the shortstop that the A's signed, that guy Nakajima, who it went horribly wrong. He was going to be their starting shortstop this year, and you know, he looked terrible in the spring. They decided to send him to the minors to let him hit his way out of it, and he never came back. He spent the year in Sacramento, and now they're on the hook for that 2-year, $6 million deal. They dropped him off at the 40 man, so he was exposed to waivers, and they clearly aren't all that interested in him anymore. And, you know, is he the sort of risk that the Mets should look at? And, you know, obviously a very low risk sort of guy where you see if he can be had for, you know, a song and pit him against the likes of Tejada and Turner and Tovar and just, you know, see who rises to the top, see what happens in spring, and, you know, hope that you can sort of put together this amalgam of, you know, a few sort of pieces of a shortstop to put to compile this like one sort of major league average shortstop.
So there you have it, folks. Amazing Avenue Audio endorses Justin Turner for 2014 Mets shortstop. Send all complaints to robcastellano@aol.com.
Funny part is I use AOL, so they'll never get there.
No, but seriously, Barbaro, Irizbel, Adoway, Baduena.
I'm still waiting to hear anything on him. I basically, you're my source for news on him. And
he's defected. I think he's in, he's waiting on, like, the usual visa stuff from last I've heard. That usually takes a month or two, depending on how quickly palms get greased.
So we should expect him to surface at some point.
Yeah, I think he'll sign with a major league team probably before the spring, certainly. Occasionally you'll see this stuff get caught up. I think that happened with either Cespedes or Puig. I don't remember which one had some issues getting some visa, establishing residency, which is usually the issue.
Well, it sort of fits into that box of, like, creative, you know, outside of the norm sort of move, and definitely would fit the needs of the Mets.
Moving on now, we will hit our prospect of the week segment. Last week was our prospect of this week, so we're not doing it every week. This week it's not even technically a prospect. Like, it's been called the X prospect of the week. But it's a guy we haven't talked about, you know, obviously use of his prospect eligibility this year, but a guy we haven't talked about a ton this offseason. And that's Juan Lagares, Rob. Juan Lagares is, as of right now, the incumbent and expected 2014 Mets starting center fielder. I mean, we talked last week about Chris Young possibly being insurance for Lagares, but it seems like it's Lagares' job to lose on the field. And he's hit well in the Dominican Winter League so far this year, hitting around .350. But that's not necessarily a ring endorsement that he's going to hit major league pitching, is it?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one thing that if you haven't learned it yet, you should. Don't count all that much on Winter League stats. They're just going to break your heart. And I'll just say one name, Dylan Owen.
Oh, man, he was like a Venezuelan Winter League killer for years.
Absolutely. No, he used to just kill it out there. I mean, you see it year in, year out, just really mediocre guys whipping up on really pretty bad competition, a lot of it being, you know, really young, inexperienced players. On the other end, you get, like, really old. Like, I think, going back to Alfonso, I think he just retired this year.
Yeah, last year he did play winter ball in Venezuela.
So, I mean, I love the guy. I think Dylan Owen probably had a really good time getting him out in the Venezuelan Winter League the last few seasons. I mean, you get that's sort of what you get is a mix of these, and then every now and then you get a player. I mean, right now Wilmer Flores is down there and he's hitting as well, so it's a strange mix, but ultimately the talent level is pretty low.
I mean, the Dominican Winter League is probably the best of the four in terms of overall talent, and even that would probably be, like, you know, high A, maybe double A level. And we know Juan Lagares can rake against high A and double A pitching. He did it in 2011 when he hit .350 between those two levels. So we're not really getting any new information. You know, good production is better than bad production, certainly. But I guess going forward, you know, he's not hitting for power. He's walked a little bit more recently, at least in the Winter League, not in Major League Baseball. Could we see maybe Lagares take a step forward in 2014? You know, hit, you know, .260, get on base at a .300 even clip, and then combine that with pretty good, you know, more than pretty good defense, and be a league average center fielder? Because I feel like that's in the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I definitely think it is. And you know what? A point that I've mentioned a couple of times, I don't know about here, someplace on the site, was that, if you sort of call out his first, 2.5 to 3 weeks where he was getting sort of sporadic playing time and was clearly suffering as a result. I mean, very rarely does a player thrive in those sort of conditions where you're starting, 3 or 4 times a week, you're getting, pinch hit opportunities, but really no consistent playing time. He wasn't doing very well, and it was once, it seemed like the season was sort of at that point lost, or at least looked like it was no longer going to be a competitive season. And Terry sort of made the move. We're going to go with this kid every day. I mean, he was basically the fourth or fifth string at that point. Ankiel was gone, numerous injuries later, and they finally decided, all right, well, we're going to go with this kid every day and see what we got. And at that point, he started to hit. Obviously, he wasn't lighting the world on fire, but he was sort of doing what we, came to expect from him. Lots of line drives. It was sort of a singles game, not a lot of patience. But, if you, like I said, if you call out that first few weeks and those at bats, suddenly you're sort of looking at that hitter that you described. I've crunched the numbers, and it sort of brings you to that level that you said, around a 260 hitter, around a 300 on base. And so suddenly, I think it's very possible that that's sort of the baseline at this point. And then, the only question remain is really, how much higher can he go? Is there a lot more projection left in that bat?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is. Obviously, I don't see much power projection. He's a pretty flat swing plane. I mean, it's a nice little swing. It's easy when he's under control, which I think he was more as he got more MLB experience under his belt. But he's never going to be an elite hitter. He's probably not going to hit 300. But he doesn't. Again, we're talking about Gold Glove level center field defense, which I didn't see coming. I think, as I said before, and frankly, I don't really. Anybody could have seen it coming, like to this level. I know you liked him more as a center fielder than I did all along, but I mean, he's going to win a Gold Glove, even if people stop running on him, which they should. Like, seriously, stop running on him. If he's a plus 10 defender in center field, he really don't have to hit much, especially in this day and age. If it's 260, 300, 380, again, not a great line, probably 10%, 15% below league average, but if you're a Gold Glove center fielder, that plays.
Yeah, and you know what? I wouldn't say that he'll never bat 300. And here's why, because he makes contact and he relies a lot on his BABIP. And not necessarily an indicator of his skills. He could very easily just get lucky some season, put up a 360 BABIP and, suddenly find his way to like a 298 batting average. And suddenly it's like, whoa, this guy's great. He's the next young Franklin Gutierrez who did the very same thing a few years ago.
Yeah, I just don't. I mean, he makes an okay amount of contact, though it was below average. I mean, his minor league numbers were all between 14 and 17% for his K rate, which would be above average. It jumped to 22, which isn't that great. But I mean, yeah, he had a 310 BABIP this year and hit 242, so I suppose he could get there if he gets the Ks a little more under control. I just don't like projecting anyone to hit 300 other than like David Wright.
Yeah, and beyond that, he's never going to walk. That's
No,
what
that's
makes
just
the
that's
thing.
not part of his game.
Right. So that idea that, he is walking more in the winter league, and I like to make this case last winter with a particular middle infield prospect that I'm not going to name right now.
We spent enough time on him. It's okay.
Exactly.
Feel like we got everyone got their money's worth.
Yeah, so we won't go back to that well, but it's nice to see that he's doing these things and he's thinking about it more. It doesn't necessarily mean that we should expect to see it come April.
Again, good production is better than bad production, but I don't think anything's really changed here. And we'll see how 2014 goes, but I think you should definitely have first crack at the job.
And actually, you mentioned about the power that we shouldn't expect too much. He's got a nice line drive stroke, so hey, maybe he's got a nice doubles game that'll appear soon.
He's
But
got a little bit of speed. I could steal him, see him maybe stealing some more. He seemed to get more comfortable stealing bases towards the end of the year. So I could see him, maybe getting 15 to 20 steals
yeah.
at the bottom of that lineup, or at the top of the lineup, depending on how many free agent signings they make.
One thing that sort of stuck in my head, and it came on the radio broadcast a couple of times, Howie said it. And I don't know where, I mean, this might have just been Howie just, randomly pulling this opinion. But more than once he said, down the road, the Mets hope that Lagares will be an 18 to 20 home run hitter. And I just don't know where
I
the hell
don't
that
think
came
that was
from.
ever in the scouting report.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he hit four last year. And let's say he takes a big step forward. I don't know that you can project more than like 10 or 12, and that's like reaching, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I could see him having a 10 home run season in there, I guess. But yeah, it's just not, that swing's not built for power.
Yeah, that was just a weird comment, and I heard it more than once, which is why it sort of sticks out. Like, what does he know that I don't? Because I don't see that coming at all. I wouldn't bet the house on that one.
Juan Lagares, not a prospect, but our prospect of the week. Time now to move on to our emails. By the way, as a brief aside, current reports are suggesting, I really, really hate the Nationals, by the way, that this deal is for Steve Lombardozzi.
And
And yeah, there is an and. It's not going to make you feel that much better, though. Either Tyler Clippard or Drew Storen.
ooh, wow, good for Rizzo for orchestrating that one.
We'll see if that actually ends up in the final deal. That is kind of crazy.
There's got to be more to that. I didn't know that doesn't add up in my
You
head.
would
There's
think,
got to be more.
because they're gonna have they don't really have another starter in their system, or really anything in their system that's gonna come to the rescue for their starting pitching. And I don't think they just have an extra starter lying around.
I mean, even if they toss in like that guy, that t the tall guy Kroll, who made a couple starts against the Mets at the end of the year, or
They could move Smiley back into the rotation too, I guess.
oh, you mean the Tigers? I'm talking about the
Yeah.
Nats.
No, the Nats
Yeah.
though, the Nats have five starters now and they're very scary.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to think what else could they put into that deal that makes sense. And
I mean, they have prospects. It's not a great system, but
yeah.
it's kind of nuts.
Wow. Yeah, that definitely stinks.
I guess
I
the
mean, for
Tigers really, really wanted a closer.
yeah, and I mean, hey, Tyler Clippard's been really strong the last few seasons. He's been one of the best setup men, and then, in his time as closer, he's been a very strong closer. Storen is another story. I sort of felt like,
I guess if they get him back to whatever he was before, because the stuff's always been nasty.
yeah, but there have been some games, I mean, some of which have come against the Mets, where you just look at him and you're like, wow, he's lost. He's just, adrift out there. There's nothing resembling what he used to be as that, dominant. And, it should be said that he never had like an extended stretch of like lockdown. He was never like Craig Kimbrell or anything like that.
No.
He was always like sort of decent, but I don't even think he was on the level of, Bobby Parnell this season.
No, that's fair, but I think there's some upside there. I imagine it'll be. I don't even know. I'm not even going to imagine who it would be because I couldn't have imagined this deal in the first place.
Yeah, bummer, because that makes the Nats a lot better.
But now, actually, onto the emails, as always, or email in this case this week. As always, you can email the podcast at amazonavenueaudio.com. And our email this week, obviously, holiday week, I'm not going to hold it against you guys. From the non-pseudonymous Max Tolkoff. 2 weeks ago, when I asked my question about baseball rosters being more like football rosters, you mentioned that the rosters were like that, there'll be no need for farm systems. That raises the question, why does baseball need a farm system at all? I'm not challenging the players that go through the farm system are better, Jose Fernandez notwithstanding, but other sports seem to get by with no or little by way of farm systems. The talent level wouldn't be as high, but couldn't Major League Baseball, in theory, be played without a farm system? They just do this by tradition. After all, a lot of the prospects can more or less keep up during spring training.
You want to take that, or do
Sure,
you?
I have a few thoughts on this. The main reason why, I guess I'm going to compare it to football specifically to start. Because basketball kind of, has a developmental league, and hockey has the juniors and some minor leagues. Though the top, obviously the top hockey picks often move into the, I don't know a lot about hockey, but I gather the top hockey picks move more quickly into the lineup than certainly their, than comparable baseball players. You're talking about basically specialized versus non-specialized skill sets here. The amount of things a center fielder has to do well to play in the majors is very different than the amount of things an offensive lineman has to do well to play in the NFL. Obviously, the speed of the game gets faster. And the level of talent around him and against him gets faster. But the basic physical skills don't really change. You know, if you're 330 pounds and have a good balance and speed, and are, you know, able to learn a more advanced playbook, you can slot in and be successful. You know, obviously, in most of these cases, in all of these sports that take their draftees into the majors or into the professional ranks more quickly, you don't expect them to immediately become superstars on the ground floor. There's always a learning curve, but they're able to contribute. With baseball players, just the difference is so, the amount of things, it's not just, it's defense, it's hitting, it's base running, it's the quality of stuff, like for a hitter, the quality of breaking balls you see is astronomically different. I just don't think there's a comparable thing in football. I guess maybe for quarterbacks, moving into a pro style offense, if they weren't in a pro style offense in college, might be the closest comparison point. We're seeing, I think, even less of that more recently, as more teams, NFL teams, sort of take things from the college game, more pistol formations, more spread options, stuff like that. Little wrinkles. There's less of a transition period. Nobody's throwing Justin Verlander's curveball in, you know, SEC baseball. It's just not happening. You know, pitch sequencing. And you can be a really good college player and not have that translate to the pro ranks, which I guess is true in football as well, and basketball, certainly. You know, J.J. Redick is not as good a professional basketball player as he is a college basketball player. And there's a litany of quarterbacks, especially. They're much better college players than NFL players. But Michael Roth, who I think was the Friday night starter for South Carolina a couple years ago when they won the College World Series, he's in the Angels system. Actually got a couple starts towards the end of last year. Absolutely dominant college starter because he could change speeds. He could throw strikes. His fastball was like 87, 88. You know, he's not a big overpowering guy. And probably won a much of a major league career. I was actually kind of surprised they called him up to make those spot starts. He was kind of getting knocked around in the Texas League. And you see that all the time. Guys that throw in the mid to upper 80s can just, if you can locate and spin a breaking ball, and you see it in the Penn League. I mean, in Brooklyn, how many Mets prospects have come through and just absolutely decimated the Penn League with mediocre stuff. It's the same kind of thing. There's just so many different things you don't see at the college level. In baseball that you see in Major League Baseball, where I don't know if there's that many, there's just less things you have to be able to do. Yeah, you know, as a football or basketball player in college compared to the pros, there's just not as much of a learning curve.
Yeah, I think it comes down to just pretty simply, and you know, taking your example of looking at football or even basketball, or any of the sports, baseball is a sport where athleticism translates least. It's a sport where, like, Matt Adams can.
That's actually that's a much better point. That basically, I just rambled for no reason. Yes, just go. I should have let you handle the question, Rob.
I'm distilling what you said.
Thank you. There you go. That's good. We'll stick with that.
The thesis of the statement here is, I mean, it's just you can be a stud athlete in baseball. It doesn't matter. There's just so much more nuance to the game that, you know, a LeBron James right out of high school, he had this athleticism to play basketball, and basketball lends itself to athleticism. Football does as well, but like you pointed out, at quarterback there's a little bit more nuance, so you don't see quite the, you know, rapid gestation period that you do at, you know, wide receiver or even better lineman, because it's not a lot of nuance there. You can let your athleticism just sort of pay the bills. Baseball, that's what baseball is. It's all nuance. I mean, you can be the greatest athlete we've ever seen, and we've seen it a million times. I mean, last things Millage was a tremendous athlete. It doesn't matter. You need to know how to play baseball to play baseball. Whereas, the same is not necessarily true for basketball. We've seen a lot of guys who can sort of fake it thanks to the fact that they can jump really high and run fast and they're strong. And, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be the best player. And a lot of times, you're going to, if you don't grow and sort of learn the game, because obviously there's a lot of nuance to all the different sports, you'll probably fall by the wayside. But at least in those sports, you can compete at a high competent level just based on your raw natural abilities. Whereas in baseball, you can't do that. You need that gestation period to learn the nuance of the game. And in no other sport is that as true as it is in baseball, which is, that's the minors. That's the reason why you have to go through that process. And you 99.9% of the time, no player can handle that jump directly from any level of amateur baseball to the big leagues.
I mean, it does happen on occasion.
Mike Leake did it.
Yeah. You'll see college relievers sometimes move very quickly. Much
Superman was an example of the rare position player.
It varies. It's much rarer with position players.
Yeah, but because like you said, they just have so much they need to do.
Right. I mean, if you're a pitcher and you can throw 95 again, it's not athleticism, quote unquote, but it's a raw tool that translates. I'm talking about if you can throw 95 and spin a breaking ball, you can move very quickly. There are pitchers in the Mets. Noah Syndergaard last year pitched out of a major league bullpen and been successful? Yeah, probably. But with hitters, it's not. Again, it's occasionally you'll see guys with one carrying tool. That tool is usually the hit tool, and the hit tool doesn't always, mature. That with Zimmerman, who's obviously a great hitter. Billy Hamilton's speed probably got into the majors faster than he would have otherwise, or maybe even at all. Elite defense. You could rush someone and Andrelton Simmons basically jumped from high A to the majors because he was an elite defensive shortstop and made it work. Didi Gregorius had a similarly large jump. I think he was in double A. So you see, there are certain athletic carrying tools that sort of compress the development time in baseball, but it's just not as common.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out that in baseball, more than any other sport, it's really hard to learn on the job. Again, in basketball, you can sort of let your ability get you by as you learn the rest of the game. Whereas in baseball, it's really hard. Like Billy Hamilton, I don't know what kind of player he's going to be because, as a guy who just consistently pinch runs and is really good at it, he's not really learning the other phases of the game. And I don't really know that he will, at least not at the major league level, which is why, you'll probably see him back in the minors to try to continue to further the seasoning to get him to the point where he can, fake it in center field or something. It's an interesting thought, though. Another interesting question from Max.
I think just to sort of put a cap on that, too, the other thing in, football and basketball, you can have your offensive lineman take 30 snaps a game or have your running back you draft it split time. In basketball, you can come off the bench for 15 minutes a night. In baseball, that actually, you can't, if you've got a top prospect, you don't want to just have him, pinch hit or come in as a defensive substitute. You need the reps. It's a repetition-based thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like with any nuance, you get the gist of it by doing it a lot. And one other point that we didn't hit on, the idea that prospects can sort of swing it during spring training. I don't know that that's necessarily, it's just too small a sample to judge anything.
I think also a lot of times they're facing pitchers and hitters that are, more veteran-y and sort of playing themselves into game shape.
Yeah.
So maybe just throwing fastballs or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the competition's not at a level that you want to start, gauging whether or not players can hang, and then it's just such a short period of time. And remember that Jordani Valdez been batted like 320 this spring training, and he looked like he forced himself onto the team, whereas, you know, Wilmer Flores batted 140. So I mean, he certainly didn't look like he could swing it, and you know, in his brief cameo this year, again, didn't look like he could really swing it. But you know, spring training really isn't, like we said about winter league baseball, it's not really a great judge. You just have to sort of trust the reps, go with the largest sample you can, and that's what the minors is for.
Yes, and that's our one email for the week. As always, you can email the podcast at podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com. And Rob, Chris Cotillo reporting that the package might be Steve Lombardozzi, Robbie Ray, and the aforementioned Ian Kroll.
Ooh, look at that. I'm on my game tonight.
You are. That's still not enough for Doug Fister.
No, I was just sort of thinking tall guy for tall guy, basically.
There you go.
Apparently so is Mike Rizzo and what's his name over in Detroit?
Dave Dombrowski.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. Tall guy for tall guy.
Didn't trade Porcello, though, who's also incredibly tall.
Well, do the Mets still have Scott Mobile? Maybe we can...
No, they don't. They don't. No. You know, I think he actually might be pitching in Australian League Baseball.
Yeah, he's still playing at some level. It's definitely.
I was pretty sure I saw that. I don't know why I was looking at Scott Mobile's baseball reference page. These are the things I do for fun.
Well, he is 6'11".
All right, that wraps up this week's edition of Amazing Avenue Audio, episode 44, the Blastings Thrillage episode. As always, this has been Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. You can find us on the interwebs at AmazingAvenue.com. You can find the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Amazing Avenue Audio, and you can listen or subscribe right there. You also find the podcast on the Stitcher app. Directly download from AmazingAvenueAudio.com or listen to the embedded player that goes up in the podcast post at Amazing Avenue proper. My co-host this week was Rob Castellano. Find him on Twitter @_RobCast, where he tweets out Winter League Baseball stats that don't really matter. I'm your host at all. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. You can find me on Twitter @JeffPaternostro, where I tweet mostly about the Sheffield Wednesday managerial vacancy.
Which I'm assuming matters?
To me and a lot of people in South Yorkshire who take it very, very seriously. I will say this for Mets fans. I don't expect when and if Sandy Alderson is fired, they will call him a pedophile on the way out the door. Maybe I might be giving them too much credit. I don't go into certain recesses of Mets Twitter that much.
What I love about soccer is like the vitriol.
That's certainly vitriolic would be the adjective I would use. So the winter meetings kick off next week, so hopefully we'll have... I don't know what I'm going to do next week. I was toying with the idea of doing like a daily podcast, but I don't know if the Mets are going to do enough where that's going to be justifiable.
Unless you want to discuss Justin Turner every day.
Yeah, it's Justin Turner. I assume they're going to tender him because he was in the Christmas card. I figured everyone in the Christmas video was safe. Pretty cold to put someone in the Christmas card video and then non-tender them. Though they've traded Santa the last couple of years, so.
That's the best logic I've heard behind the non-tender decisions so far as far as the Mets.
Omar Quintanilla, not in the Christmas card video.
Glaringly missing. Yeah. Scott Atchison.
Yes, glaringly. It was probably past his bedtime. Get one last Scott Atchison old joke on the way out the door.
He would have been a great Santa.
Yeah, even though they stopped being entertaining around May 15th, I think. All right, so that's episode 44. We'll see all of you next week for episode 45, our Except winter meetings Jordani edition. Except for Jordani Valdez, Ben Rob.
Jordani, we hardly knew ye.